This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
your award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, on the job site. Did you know that a big portion of people who listen to Joy at work, just like you? Right now, times are very tough financially, and without your support, Joy may not be around to help you through your work day. So tell your workmates, your next door neighbour, and even your mum to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
This is Saturday Magazine.
Saturday Magazine, Joy 94.9, Macca and Dano. So Misha Ketchell is the editor of The Conversation. Misha is a regular. Good morning, Misha. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very good.
Now, I'm not Tom Elliott.
You're not Tom Elliott, no.
I'm not Tom Elliott. I was driving one day recently and I heard... And Tom's actually co-hosted a couple of times. I've got to say, Tom is a slightly different personality when he's in the studio.
I can imagine.
Which he acknowledges to when he's on AW. But I listened to him, giving you a bit of a lashing about moderating comments or removing comments. But I don't think Tom got it that this is a site that is predominantly contributed to by academics and journalists. But it's about facts. It's about evidence-based reporting, as opposed to anything from News Corp's.
Yeah, not only that, I mean, I think it's really important to understand that anybody in the media, in any media organisation, exercises some form of editorial curation. To ensure that their audience is well-informed. So when I was talking to Tom, he was sort of saying that he has somebody who writes to him every day about a particular issue, and I said, that's fine, Tom, but you don't put that person on air every single day. You might put them on air once and give them a chance to have their say.
Or read their comment.
But there's a certain point at which you say, okay, you've had your say now, and it's time to move the debate on. And our policy, which is really about moderating people who are peddling certain memes about climate science denialism, basically is that they seem to be a very small group who tend to post a lot. They take a disproportionate share of the public discourse, and what they do is misleading. It certainly is misleading in the context of where you're publishing people who actually know what they're talking about, and it sort of works against a proper understanding of the issues, so we've taken a decision to be active in curating that content. Now, it did get Erica Betts to go into Parliament and accuse us of being...
Erica?
Yes. was it Hitler and Stalin and... which, you know...
Now, hang on. Hasn't Eric got his family history? Wasn't his... Otto... Otto a bit. Anyway.
I don't know. I've got no comment to make at this time.
So, Monsieur, it's really about weighing up, giving equal or some semblance of equal, ability to say something on your site to as many people as possible, but without letting certain groups dominate from either side.
That's right. And also, it's interesting, actually. There's a philosopher by the name of Tim Dean who's written a really interesting piece. He works at the St. James Ethics Centre, amongst other places, talking about the ways in which we think about free speech and whether free speech is actually, to some extent, failed public discourse. And he gives this great example. He says, look, so much of our free speech is about being polite, being courteous, reinforcing relationships. He gives the example. He says, if somebody says to you, does my bum look big in this? The correct answer is always no, irrespective of the truth, right? So most free speech is not about truth. But when we talk about free speech in the context of democracy, of our public discourse, of what we want to achieve as a society, what we're really doing is we're using free speech in the service of sort of a finding of truth, moving towards a certain kind of truth.
And it is always good to have, a discussion along those lines, isn't it?
Yeah. I'll come back to that. So basically what Tim Dean was arguing was that our idea of free speech now in the internet age actually is not functioning to serve truth in a way that we would hope. You'll find that there's a lot of discussion. There's a really interesting piece this week in the New Yorker about 8chan and those really far-right hate sites, for example. And they become really about a solidification of a certain set of attitudes in many ways that are sort of antisocial or anti, you know, the public good.
So those who have the loudest and most persistent voices.
That's right. And, I mean, part of your job, obviously, if you're a journalist in any forum, whether it be a newspaper or on a radio station or moderating comments on a website, is to ensure that... A fair range of perspectives are presented, but also to ensure that you don't mislead your audience, that you don't provide information that might give them the wrong impression about, for example, the state of the science on climate change. So that was the decision we made. It actually was incredibly uncontroversial in that newspapers all over the world have taken this decision. The Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, like it's a very widespread position. But it sort of suits certain people on the right of politics to sort of portray it as an attack on free speech. Well, in actual fact, it isn't, because free speech has never been about your right to go into a room and dominate a conversation, whether that room be a physical room at a symposium, whether it be dominating, you know, talkback radio, or whether it be dominating a comment stream.
But, you know, newspapers, print newspapers and digital, they decide what letters they will publish.
Of course.
So what's the difference?
Well, there is no difference. That's the point.
You know, and you know, we get messages here that we don't always read out on air because of the nature of it, or, you know, because it might be a bit dodgy. But, you know, so I don't understand what the difference is. I mean, you know, if every person, you know, and, you know, if every person that rang up and spoke to the producer of Neil Mitchell's program or Tom Elliott's program and some of the things they said, if it went to air, you know, it'd be pretty horrendous listening.
Well, every so cultural gatekeeper has to have some kind of policy that they can adhere to on a reasonably consistent way, surely.
Yeah. And we've actually got a message, a question from a listener there, Lisa.
Yeah, so great to hear Misha again, is what our listener says. Please ask him what his view about the mainstream media coverage of the climate change activists is.
Oh, God.
interesting topic.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's been actually quite a bit written. In fact, we've got a piece by a psychologist in The Conversation this week talking about the different forms of climate denialism, the way we think about it. And I think, for example, if you look at the way that Greta Thunberg has been characterised and treated...
Well, it's become a personal thing rather than the actual issue itself, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And it's a real... you can see sort of a generational sort of conflict there, the desire to dismiss, the desire to discredit. It's what I would characterise really as sort of emotional thinking, not intellectual thinking. I mean, there's no reason why somebody like Greta Thunberg, who has, through her actions, basically taken a leadership role, shouldn't be, to some extent, you know, respected and listened to. Not to say that everything she says is right. But I think that you've really seen a really good example in the past few weeks of the ways in which the sort of the people who are very resistant to these types of movements are thinking very emotionally, and the level of anger and the level of aggression and the level of just disrespect, I think, has been very interesting.
Well, it does smack of an older generation being very upset, sort of being owned or spoken to by a 16-year-old female as well. I think the gender comes into it, and it's certainly the age, and perhaps her so-called mental health issues.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, the idea that it would be acceptable to talk about somebody's alleged mental health issues in that way, for anybody, I mean, it would just be incredibly offensive.
No, it's outrageous.
But suddenly, for this young person, it's all bets are off. Mm. I mean, it just seems incredible that this is where our culture is at right now. And it tells you something about the emotional force of the resistance to these ideas. I mean, these ideas are very threatening to a lot of people.
Well, I was just going to touch on the fact, on the word fear.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fear around it in terms of, are we going to lose our voices here to a young teenager?
That's right. And I think the other thing that's interesting is the power with which these issues are being prosecuted is affecting the public debate. I mean, the Labor Party now is tearing itself apart about its target to reduce CO2 emissions by 45% by 2030. And people like Joel Fitzgibbon are sort of talking out and saying we need to sort of take a minimalist approach.
It strikes me that
an interesting group of people, isn't he?
It strikes me that some of the argument has become about, oh, we're terrifying the children. Yeah. Like, it's actually moved away from the actual debate about the facts and the science to, oh, we can't terrify the children. Yeah. Well, maybe the children need to be terrified.
Well,
at some level.
It was interesting, actually. I went to Queensland last week and I had a conversation with a very well-known economist by the name of John Quiggin. And he was saying that he thinks that we should change the voting age and we should actually reduce it to 12, which might sound extraordinary and extreme and unusual.
Well, then they'd be on the level with some of our politicians.
Well, that's, I mean, you could argue that. But basically his point is that the reason that we've got it at 18 is because of an idea about capacity, right? Now, there's actually quite a lot of research about intellectual capacity and decision-making, and the research would show that most 12-year-olds would actually have intellectual capacity to make informed decisions. Obviously, the decisions that you're making when you make political decisions are about a longer-term future, which they have got, you know, a significant interest in. And there are no capacity questions asked at the other end of the age spectrum. So when you're 78 or 88 or 98, nobody is saying, you know, you can't exercise the vote. So Quiggin's argument actually is that we should be sort of broadening that capacity for young people to have a say about the future. And I think, you know, on the face of it, that, you know, it's quite a compelling argument.
I certainly have 15-year-olds in my life that I'm close to who think very carefully and seriously and actually do research about various topics that are important to them.
I think, yeah, 12, my gut tells me probably not.
Too young, yeah.
But I think definitely 16. There are a number of legal requirements that change when you turn 16. So I think, you know, that would be a good place to start. 12? Not sure. Not sure.
It's interesting, yeah.
But, yeah, I, you know, of course, some states in America, it's 21. And, in fact, the drinking age in some states in the US is 21.
Which is strange, I think. I mean, in America, there's this...
But conscript, you know, you could be called up at 18.
Yeah, it's a very...
For the military.
I mean, this idea of... I mean, the way they talk about young people in America, if you're at college, they talk about college kids.
Yeah.
And they're still treated as sort of children in a certain way. Whereas in Australia, there is a general sort of your age of sort of what they call majority or, you know, coming of age is 18 legally. It's a very different culture. But I just think if you look at the ways in which, for example, the climate change debate is playing out and the level of emotional and, I would argue, not very rational thinking that's characterising it, I would argue that rather than trying to demonise and represent young people as, say, having mental illness or not being people to whom we should listen, I would actually say that they've obviously, you know, got interesting things to say and a very significant interest in the outcome of this that, you know, will affect them long after we're all gone. So,
well, it wouldn't matter in Hong Kong, would it? Because your voting doesn't matter.
No, and that's obviously a separate issue. That's a very complex and in many ways very depressing issue.
Do you think, and sorry, just to happy to come back to climate, but Hong Kong, I have a real fear that this is you know, we've already seen protesters shot at point blank range, and I've looked at that footage many times. Okay, I wasn't there, I wasn't the police officer, but I make the observation that I didn't perceive by the images that I saw that he felt he was at risk. But do you, you know, what does your gut tell you, Misha? Do you think this is really now at a point, it is at a point, I think, of no return, but how much worse is it going to get?
Oh, look, I really am not in a position to predict the future on China. I mean, it's so, it's a very moving situation. I think what I would say is that around the world at the moment, it feels to me as though the idea of democracy is
under threat.
Yeah. And we're seeing different forms of leadership. I mean, obviously in China, you know, to some extent that's long been the case. But if you look at the US, if you look at the UK, the idea about listening to voices and sort of that pluralism and tolerance, which has always been a fragile idea, you can see its fragility in Hong Kong. You can see the sort of very precarious tolerance of the protests. And, I mean, the big question, which is going to be how long will that sort of forbearance continue? I don't know the answer, but I, like you, am, you know, very worried about it.
Look, I'm pretty fearful, and I think that, you know, the challenge is going to be how that plays out. The most interesting thing about Hong Kong is actually the diversity, the age, and the where these people are in society that are demonstrating.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, Macca and Lisa Daniel, Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation, and Misha's not going to write a book, but I reckon he'd have a book in him. And I'm going to think about what it should be.
Surely you do a PhD.
You tell me.
You do a PhD so you can get the doctor.
Yeah, yeah, you want to be Dr. Ketchell. Yeah.
But I sort of figure 3 years just so, like, once every now and then when you're booking a restaurant you can say doctor. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
It doesn't really stack up.
And you probably get called to emergencies on flights and that sort of thing.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you see, the abbreviation of doctor is DR, the abbreviation of counsellor is CR, but it could also be debit or credit.
That's true. Okay. And that's an interesting insight into how your mind works.
Isn't it? Isn't it? Now, what else did you want to talk about, Misha? Because there's been so much in the news and the conversation covers such a broad range of subjects. I mean, we've climate change, but we've seen some interesting news about Google around this issue, haven't we?
Yes, there was a really interesting story in The Guardian, which was about the money that Google is giving to organisations that spread climate denialism. And one of them, interestingly, is an organisation called the Heartland Institute, or an organisation that was a peak body that's giving money to Heartland. Now, Heartland is famous because it was also... it's been involved for many years with climate science denialism, but it was also involved with the science that was spread, or the misrepresented science around tobacco and its health impacts. So it's sort of been an organisation that's done a lot of damage to public discourse and the public good by spreading misinformation about significant matters of public interest. There's another organisation called the Competitive Enterprise Institute that Google's been funding. And it's really interesting because Google's tried to present itself as being very strong on... global warming, and it's tried to be sort of carbon neutral in its activities. And given the huge global focus on these platforms, the fact that they're funding these sorts of institutions,
so why are they,
is interesting.
Do we know why they're funding them? I mean, do they fund organisations on the other side of these issues? Or, you know, are they getting some balance there, or are they just being ratbags?
They're good questions. Look, I haven't looked at the entire list of everybody they funded, and I'm sure that there is a breadth. I mean, I think what really this reporting was about was identifying these particular sort of institutions that are spreading misinformation and the fact that they're being funded. To some extent, it might be inadvertent. I mean, they may not have known, or they might have had a program of...
Perhaps they should have done a Google search.
Yes. Well, that might be a good idea. But it is interesting. Again, it sort of goes to that question of the sort of free speech culture which exists in America, which is let a thousand flowers bloom. But the problem is do you really want to fertilise weeds? You know, do you really want to encourage things that are actually going to hold us back?
You know what you fertilise weeds
with? I don't know where this is going, but you go ahead.
I think manure is the manure. Right way to say it,
I mean, you know, we already know that Google engages in censorship.
Yes.
It engages in commercial censorship.
Yes.
And political censorship. And, you know, it kowtows to oppressive regimes on the right and the left. I suppose I'm not really surprised that they're doing this, but they probably... I'd be interested as to their reason as to why they're doing it. Like, what's their justification?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be part of a program of encouraging institutions that are sort of, you know, participants in public debate. You know, it's this idea of, you know, a lot of organisations that have a lot of financial resources will make these types of investments in a range of organisations. But it's really interesting given the amount of power that Google has currently and the global sort of discussion about regulating it, just where, you know, precisely where some of that money's going. So I thought that was a really interesting report. And it's a conversation which is continuing on.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of talk about ways of taxing the digital platforms and the responsibilities that they're taking. So
the challenging thing for people in the internet age is finding the layers of interest in organisations. Like, there seems to be a lack of transparency that I'm not sure was there before in terms of corporate life or people that are very active, like, you know, like Google. Like, it's hard for the average person to find out what their financial interests are in terms of their relationships with other corporates. It's a challenge, I think, if you're interested in that, to find out who is aligned with who.
That's true, and there's an extraordinary level of concentration of wealth and power that's been brought about by really the success of these huge global companies, which are very hard for any one country to regulate. So,
and even when you do hear about things rumoured, like there was a famous, you know, coffee shop, you know, franchise that was aligned with a Christian group, and I don't even know if that's true, but it's been peddled so often that it feels like it is true. So, you know, we have to be extra vigilant with to trying to research our own, you know, finding out who's aligned with who, but even then you don't know if it's true anyway.
Which is interesting, because, I mean, what you're saying is that in an online environment where your experience of the information you find is framed by Google, you can't work out the truth.
Yes. Exactly. It's a little bit scary.
So what's happened is Google's, you know, basically shoved aside the media, stolen all the money that journalists used to get, or you could argue won in a competitive environment, and now it's running a product where you don't know what's accurate.
But you also have the situation where what's happening is, you know, most people when they do a Google search will probably look at two pages, perhaps only one. So it's where those searches appear and how Google decide how it's, you know, is it going to appear because it's that subject or because they think that take on that subject is more important.
But it's also monetized.
Of course.
Like, you can pay to be...
Of course.
So, again, whatever comes up in your search is manufactured in a whole variety of ways.
Yeah.
There's actually a terrific Australian author and journalist, a guy called Gideon Haig, who wrote an article in The Monthly a long time ago, maybe 12 years ago now, like very early on in the life of Google, talking about, as a researcher, the way in which it had reframed the world for him. Mm. He was used to doing so much research in libraries and archives and different environments, and the way in which now what Google feeds up frames your reality.
It does.
Such a prescient piece, like it really looked forward to something that now, you know, our whole world is framed by these companies.
Yeah. Anything coming up in the conversation apart from normal that we look forward to? Anything, you know, anything that you can give us a bit of a hint that might really ring our bell?
Yeah, we're actually working at the moment on a quite significant series, and we're in the very early phases, about the 250th anniversary commemoration of Cook's journey.
Yep.
And, like, I'm not the best historian in the world, but as I understand it, at the moment we're roughly 250 years on from when he would have been in New Zealand,
yep.
and there's been some coverage in New Zealand.
Yep.
Probably by early next year would have been when he was in the east coast of Australia. And what we're really wanting to do is look at it from the full range of perspectives, so sort of the mixed legacy, the way different Maori groups have responded to Cook, the way he's understood Indigenous Australians, the science, the time in the Pacific, Hawaii. We're trying to pull together something that will really go to the significance of that legacy in the same way the New York Times did a fantastic piece of reporting around 1619, which is a very important year in US history. And it's really a year that sort of inaugurated the, you know, sort of slavery, racism sort of at the heart of, of that country's history. So we're trying to do something a little bit like that, but with sort of, you know, the role of Cook.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Misha Ketchell from The Conversation, editor of The Conversation, thank you.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.